Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Ben Hunter. And we're about to get a lesson in all the biggest and hardest things in the universe from Chris Ferry. Welcome to the Booktopia podcast.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Now, you've got an ever-growing range of board books.
Yes.
Explaining some of the biggest concepts known to man to really quite young babies and toddlers. Is that a way of describing it? Because, I mean, I learn from them as well, so I don't want to sort of discount my learnings from your books.
I think that's a fair way to describe them, though in reality, it's for the parents, not so much for the babies. But I've heard that, you know, older children are learning from them, and I've went to my children's classrooms and, you know, year two, year three students, you know, I just cover up the four babies part and they're learning things from them as well.
Well, these concepts, a lot of them are so mind-bending that they seem unreal. So wouldn't it be the perfect place to introduce these ideas to the flexible minds of children?
Sure, yeah. I mean, children are little scientists. They're exploring the world. And you know, at some point we put them in school and then we fail to teach them these concepts. And then we ask later on, at what age should we introduce science? But, you know, we only ask that question because we've taken it away. We've stifled it at some point. Mm. I don't see any reason why we can't just teach it, you know, right from birth.
So how did you become you? How did you end up having all these wonderful board books in bright colors with your name on front?
Well, that's a long story. So I certainly wouldn't have started writing children's books if I didn't have children of my own. As a, you know, single university student, the world of parenting is a completely different world. You don't understand comedians that talk about their kids. You don't understand these TV shows about family. And then you have kids, and then it just opens up this whole new world, including children's books. So I started reading children's books, and after having a few kids, I started to get bored of reading the same old children's books over and over, and I kind of lamented that there wasn't anything about science for kids. So I thought I'd just write my own book. The first versions weren't bright. They still had my name on them, but they weren't brightly colored because I had self-published them. So they were available in the U.S., self-published for a few years, and then I picked up a publisher, and they had designers that told me it will look better this way.
were they gentle with you?
Yeah. No, I mean, when they showed me the first covers, I was like, oh, yeah, I can, yes. Yes, I see why you get paid to be a designer and I don't.
Do you think it's something you would have had to have gone down the road of self-publishing for? This is such an impossible pitch to go to a publisher and say, I want to write about quantum physics for babies.
Yeah, I think so. What the publisher told me was that this wasn't supposed to work. I mean,
authors this.
I wasn't an author, so I hadn't tried to publish books before, and so I was pretty naive, and I just threw it out there kind of as a hobby, you know, because my day job is academic research, so this was a hobby, and I put it up online, and just let people buy it, and I wasn't, you know, didn't know what would happen, didn't have any expectations, and it started selling.
And at the time, were you working inside a faculty in a university? Were you sort of pitching this to your friends?
I brought the first copy that was just for myself, and I brought it to my child's preschool and showed the teachers, and they looked at the first one was quantum physics for babies. They looked at the cover and they kind of laughed, and I said, no, open it. There's stuff on the inside too. And they opened it and they're like, oh, this is really good. You know, you should publish this. So I started printing off copies, and I'd give them to my colleagues, and certainly people that I had met that I knew had children or were having children. But, you know, it was selling online 10 or 12 copies a day. And so that, for a physical book, was, I guess, pretty good for a self-published book. No marketing until late 2015, when Mark Zuckerberg shared a photo of him reading it to his It does pay. Sorry.
So, I need to get that
So, yeah, a lot of other academics, they'll email me and ask me for advice, and the only thing I can offer is get celebrity endorsement.
It's great advice. Yeah. Any introductions? No, I can't help you with that. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
So where are we up to now? How many books are in this series?
So in the board books, in this Baby University board book series, there's about 20 books. I have two picture books and then another kind of novelty board book called Eight Little Planets. And that was the most recent one.
Yeah.
So that was the first one that I didn't illustrate on my own. And you can, if you put them side by side, you can tell. So there's a prop, you know, a really good illustrator. It turned out beautifully.
So to do what you do, you need to know the ideas pretty well. Like I remember reading Dostan Gada's Sophie's World. And it's sort of the history of philosophy in for 12-year-olds. And I remember thinking, because I was doing philosophy at the time, thinking, like, I'm grappling with this in a normal format, and you've taken it and you've molded it and you've made it so clear that I can understand as a young kid, you know, what's going on here. In the same way that when I first picked up the first one that they sold into us of your books, I went, because, you know, I've struggled. There have been flashes of moment, like, tiny moments where I thought I've understood, you know, certain things like relativity, and I remember reading E=mc² and going, wow, you've done a really good job. I've almost got this. This is the closest I've ever come. But to know it that well and then be able to condense it down, is this something that you find easy? Is this how your brain works? Is this?
Yeah, I think from teaching, you have to think about things in many different ways. I think when you first learn something, you have like one way in which you understand it, and that's the way that someone else told you. And I feel like that's not really understanding. Not until you have different points of view, and at least one of which you've created on your own, where you really have an understanding. And when you get to that point, it becomes really easy to kind of tell it in different ways and create different stories for that same thing. So I don't find it difficult, but, you know, again, I've been doing this for 20 years. And attempting to teach it to my kids and other adults and then university students. So I've attempted to explain it at various levels already. I think one of the things that being an expert gets you is not so much the content, but the confidence to know that what you've written is correct. You know, because I could, you know, write a book about any scientific topic, you know, a board book, because it's not very deep, because it can't be. So that information is freely available. You know, you can get it online, but it's the confidence that you know it's correct. I think that's what a lot of people are lacking.
And in the range is getting bigger and bigger. Are you going to wander outside of your areas of expertise and you have to come and ask people, hey, have you already done that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I've already done that. So organic chemistry for babies, I have a co-author who's a chemist, right? So
do you film those moments when you sit down and try to work it out together?
Some of them are with people who I know in Sydney, and others are, it's done collaboratively online, you know, with Skype and other tools. So, yeah, it's interesting.
The way you described how you got to it and how you know a subject is different from that other person on the other side. So the way in which they may be. I remember running into a couple of guys at a party who were in this deep philosophical discussion arguing about one of these big subjects. And then I found them later on. They were really heated. And I found out later on they were actually arguing the same point, but they just had been taught differently.
Right.
Right. Sort of coming around in different directions. Do you find that someone has a great expertise in their area, you've come up with an idea of their area, and trying to find that simplest way of explaining it?
Yeah, so at this point, I've gotten it down to kind of a formula where I can tell another expert, you know, here's the formula, here's what we need. You know, every book starts, this is the ball, and on the 24th page says, now you know, philosophy, for example. Yeah. So we need to tell a story that goes from a ball to now you know this topic. And it usually takes four or five different takes, and then I see something that I think will work, and then I kind of mangle it, because, you know, experts, they'll throw in a lot of jargon, especially at topics like biology, where, you know, every word is 20 syllables long. Mm-hmm. It was really challenging. So, you know, I would change the story and then throw it back and say, you know, how bad did I screw up the science? And we go back and forth until we kind of hit on something. Yeah. So it's a process where, yeah, you're throwing a lot out there and you're kind of shaving things off until you whittle it down to something that works.
Have you got an idea of who your audience is? Like, what kind of people are buying books and why they're buying them?
I think that for the most part, like, if I picked a random person that's bought one of these books, it's probably as a gift, baby shower gift for an educated friend. I hear lots of stories, like, someone will buy organic chemistry, for example, because they have a chemist who is having their first child, something like that. So I think the customers, or the readers, are parents who have studied a topic related to the title of the book. Yeah.
So you're just going down at the university, looking down the list of subjects, going, I can conquer all of these different areas and go down the specialties next and go down small yeah. scroll and just have a book for every single opportunity.
Yeah, I think, you know, the publisher would be very happy if I did that. but, you know, my children are growing. I don't have babies anymore. So the value that I personally get out of it is diminishing. And I'm thinking about writing things for, you know, for my children as they grow older.
So, yeah. Stories or more?
Yeah. So
nonfiction or sort of
nonfiction. Yeah. Well, I mean, I still have three children that will read picture books. So, and I like doing the picture books. The first two were scientific parodies. So there's Goodnight Lab, which is a parody of Goodnight Moon. And Scientist, Who Do You See? Which is a parody of Brown Bear, What Do You See? So those are really fun. That's kind of my style of humor.
Yeah.
So I like doing those. And I've been thinking about writing, like, kind of first chapter books, you know, for that year two, year three mm-hmm. audience.
So you're just going to just expand your range as the children expand?
Yeah, well, I think that one of the reasons that it has to be that way is because, again, you know, I have a full-time job, so this has to be, you know, if my employer is listening, this is a hobby. And I am doing the research for free, right? Because I'm reading the books at my children's level already. So I'm doing that research to find out, you know, what's working, what isn't working. You know, so I couldn't just jump into, you know, teen fiction because I haven't read that in 20 years and my children aren't old enough to read that yet. But once they do, then I get to do that research for free.
The ones that leap to mind is, because there have been a few horrible histories kind of things which sort of led towards science, but I don't think anyone's really done it in the way, you know, really specifically to these particular areas for that age group from say 6 to 12 in that range. Being able to keep,
yeah, there's...
I look forward to it because I learned a lot from those books. They're much easier to read than the other ones.
Yeah, I've noticed that, I mean, there's science... like topics, but a lot of it is most of it is science fiction, you know, so time travel with dinosaurs and lasers and things like that. And I would like to try to find a way to make it exciting, but also real science, real technology.
One of my favorite books is Bill Bryson's History of Nearly Everything, I read and reread. And the great thing about that book is An Ignorant Man Holds Your Hand and takes you into this. But when he does have his discussions with the experts throughout, it is, for the layperson, such a wonderful introduction to these enormously complicated subjects. And the one place that he lets us down in that book is the area that you're writing about for. For the very small, because he doesn't really know that area very well, and it's very difficult for the experts to kind of explain it in a way that makes sense for him to be able to then make it easy for me. So I'm just going to sit back and wait for your kids to get into the late teens and
right.
early 20s for you to come out with some really clear explanations of quantum computing and quantum physics for adults
sure.
and me.
Yeah, I mean, I've read lots of popular science books on quantum physics. It's notoriously difficult to... Well, I mean, even for researchers, it's a difficult thing to come to grips with.
Mm-hmm.
I think it represents a really fascinating part of science where it's absolutely necessary for all the technology that we have today, yet we can't seem to agree on what it all means.
Yeah. Well, there's that side of things as well, which is then the meaning of it all. You know, there's that wandering down into philosophy, which a lot of scientists don't really like, the philosophy. I remember seeing an interview with a quantum physicist who was like, yeah, the worst part about my job is I spend most of my time doing philosophy and not science. It's all speculation. And I hate philosophy.
Yeah, I think you can work in... The nice thing about quantum physics is it has a lot of space to work in, right? So you can go and work on the experiments and not think about the philosophical implications of it at all. Or you can actually, you know, be a philosopher and think about quantum physics as well, at the other end of the extreme.
Yeah. Can you talk about your day job? Just what sort of things are you doing in your day job, the job that we have to respect more than your writing?
Yeah, so I my title is senior lecturer, so I work at the University of Technology Sydney in the Center for Quantum Software and Information. And the title is a bit strange. I think it comes from the old British system. I don't actually lecture. I just do research. And day to day, I spend most of my time mentoring PhD students and talking to my research group about kind of specific problems in quantum software, which is broadly defined as the things that we think will run on a future quantum computer, which we don't have yet.
Mind-blowing. Bob Brain is... let's return to your board book. So with the publication of the books, you're now sort of, you know, your day job is being encroached upon, because these are becoming quite successful. So will there be a point where you actually, I mean, not that we're recording this.
Yeah, I don't know. I really enjoy research. I think the only reason that I work on the books is because it's a hobby. If it was something I had to do to maintain an income, then I probably wouldn't enjoy it as much. Mm-hmm. So I think right now it's the best of both worlds, really. So I can do my research when I'm inspired to do that, and then I can work on the books when inspiration strikes. So I think for the foreseeable future, I'll continue to do both because I think it works. It really goes kind of hand in hand. I think thinking about things, you know, thinking about teaching your research to babies is actually useful in teaching it to other academics. Not, I'm not trying to say that they're babies, but if we weren't recording, so it's actually pretty useful. Yeah.
Chris, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us. It's been such a pleasure.
Yes,
thank you.
It sounds like your brain is limited. Like,
oh, thank you.
That scared us a little bit there. But he's not doing a great day job. I now regret that question. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
And you can get hold of Chris's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.